Accession number 22099, Rule 4.
Captain David Render, Reel 3, Side 1.
So now we've got to the stage where I had done one day under instruction and in action. I'd fired at nothing in particular. I'd occasionally seen movement going on, and Neville Fern, Lieutenant Fern, later Captain, was very cool and calm. And we then moved on. The next day I became a full-blown troop leader, and we then went to areas such as Roray and Tilly, where we literally stood on the edge of a field, and the Germans were on the other side of the field. Of course, it was at Saint-Pierre where John Semkin, Major Semkin, was confronted with the tank, and I was in fact with Neville Fern in a field doing a little on foot recce, which is the sort of thing that tank troop leaders often did, but of course it was a very serious, heinous crime in the eyes of the colonel, because Captain Bethel Fox, for instance, who was one of the officers who was killed, I think, and some of these others who were killed were walking about, and we had a lot of casualties through people swanning about, as we called it, and the colonel got very angry with us and gave us a lecture to say, don't get out of the tank, we didn't bring these blooming great things over here to have nobody in them, so it's wrong for you to do that. But nevertheless, one tended to do it on occasions because you could see more. And it was on the occasion when I was in the field with Neville Fern in the early days, and suddenly I saw on my right there was a head whizzing along, obviously in some sort of vehicle, I knew not what. And when I looked closely, I could see that it was a German cap. They had a distinctive type of berry, and it was travelling in the direction from ahead of us to behind us on my right. And we realised, Neville and I, that it was heading straight for John Semkin, this head. And so we rushed back to the tank, and by this time, of course, we got there. The action that John Semkin has described in another tape, i.e. when he suddenly saw straight in front of him an enormous tank, a Tiger, taking up the entire width of the road, heading straight at him. And, of course, as you know, and this is nothing to do with me, but he fired at it, and a very lucky shot hit the gun mantlet, and the glancing blow went through the driver's compartment roof, compartment lid, entry lid, because it's not very thick metal, by comparison with the rest of it, and killed the driver and made the crew bail out. And when they looked up the spout, I might tell you, there was of the German tank, there was a round up the spout, which was just as well it didn't fire, but the crew bailed out before they did. John says that when he fired, it covered the complete area in smoke, and he just fired straight into the smoke. He didn't know what he was firing at, but he just fired, which was the sort of thing we often did. But
how much did you know about the enemy in front of you? How much did you know about the Germans that you were facing?
Well, to be honest about it, very little, really. The the interesting thing about it in retrospect is, of course, that the best people, like our Sergeant Dring, were in fact countrymen. In other words, they would recognise things that other people didn't altogether notice. What I'm talking about there is, for instance, if you camouflaged your tank, because we all went around looking like an enormous bush if we could, if you put it, put holly all over it, and you were in a yew tree hedge, I mean, it stood out. This sort of thing is what I'm talking about. One of the things that one could easily forget, of course, was that your tracks were usually very shiny and they would stand out, but you had to know what you were looking for. Another thing, of course, that was interesting from our point of view was that the tanks, the German tanks, generally speaking, had two big fans on the engine covers which shot the fumes straight up into the air. You've got to realise that a tank is very much like a ship. It has a sort of bilge in the bottom of water and oil and one thing and another, and there's always this sort of fumey stuff that's sloshing about anyway, and of course the exhaust. And they, whereas in our case, first of all, ours just belted straight down on the ground and caused huge great clouds of dust which gave our position away and of course caused a lot of trouble. But then they put a deflector which got rid of the fumes and the exhaust and blew it up in the air. You've got to realise, of course, that the tank, I think the Germans must have been the same as ours, but our Shermans, for instance, had about a 4-foot fan immediately behind your back, which was, when the engine was running, was whizzing round, and so sucking the air out through the engine from the gun compartment, from the turret, because when you fire the gun and the breech opens, you immediately get a lot of fumes, and if you have those trapped, that can do you in. You can't breathe those. So in the circumstances, they'd have this fan going. So you were standing in the tank in an actual gale all the time. There's a wind. At first, very uncomfortable, but in the end, you sort of get used to it somehow. It brings a lot of dust in, and of course, you get, that's why we used to have goggles and so on. But the thing was that it would the German tanks would be blowing these fumes vertically up into the air. And so consequently, one of the things that I found very useful to look at was the ambience of the trees in front of you, because don't forget, it was very woody ground, Villers-Bocage, were disturbed. If the trees were shaking, you'd look very carefully, and gradually, it took you a minute or two, but you could pick out the fact that there was a tank there and exactly where he was. And of course our system would be that as soon as we found them, we would then phone up to the other, you know, radio the other tanks, your Baker and your Charlie tank, sergeant and the corporal, and make them fire all together at that tank. If there was another troop nearby, you could talk to them as well, and everybody on the command fire would fire as hard as they could. Our big thing was, of course, that whenever we moved or had to move, we didn't until we had, as we called it, brassed up the area. We just fired and fired and fired for about 15 minutes. And don't forget, a Sherman 75 could probably get up to 3 or even 4 rounds of ammo in the air at any one time if it was over a sufficient distance. That's unlike, of course, the 88, which was a very, very tough gun and all the rest of it, and very effective. But the fact of the matter was that their rate of fire wasn't anything like as quick as ours. And in the case of, say, the famous Tiger tank, incidentally, there were only a few Tigers, and everybody talks as if there were hundreds of them, but of course there weren't. Most of them were Mark IVs or Panthers. But the thing is that they were very, very slow in traverse, and we always regret that we were never told this sort of thing. They should have, I think people knew the position, the engineers or whoever it was behind the scenes. But it would have been a help if we had known that it took some time before they could get the gun to bear on us. But nevertheless, their rounds were much heavier and bigger than ours, and so they couldn't get off the rate of fire. But of course, their sights and everything were so much more accurate than ours. Their cupola prisms enabled them to reasonably fight hull down, you know, close down rather. Whereas we couldn't. I mean, without any doubt, you couldn't fight a Sherman unless you've got your head out. In fact, I'd go a bit further than that and say you can't fight any blinking tank unless you've got your head out. That, of course, put us into a very vulnerable position as far as your head was concerned, because we never, ever went into action with a tin hat on. We always went, unlike the infantry, we always went with a berry. And I might tell you, if you think of a BlackBerry, and we had black headsets and a black microphone and dirty hands, black hands, and you got a pair of black binoculars, it was a sort of smudgy look as far as the enemy were concerned. And the enemy, to a big extent with us, of course, were snipers. They had these chaps in the camouflage suits up in the trees with super sights on their rifles, and they were apparently super shots. And they picked off a whole lot of our people. We lost a lot of tank commanders through being sniped. But personally, my answer on that one, more by luck than judgment, was the fact that on a Sherman, on my Sherman anyway, there was a bracket sticking up on the commander's cupola, which was used for supporting a rifle for anti-aircraft or for a machine gun they had on the top. Well, we didn't have anything on there at all. Certainly no rifle, but certainly not a machine gun. We relied on having Schmeisers. If we could loot a German Schmeisser, which would fold up the butt, and then you could hold it right close up to your chest, a machine pistol, that was quite okay with 9mm ammunition. In fact, I had to use that in earnest, because when we were at Tilly, we drove straight into a German line of SS troops, and they were all around us, and we fired left and right as best we could, but these blokes came, in my case, one of them came running up the tank, clambering up the tank, trying to put a stick grenade in, and I just shot him off with a 9mm Schmeisser, their own gun, of course. But going back to the question of your head out, the position was that on this bracket that I was talking about, which carried the machine gun or whatever in the original design, I used to put my tin hat and the goggles, because you didn't wear goggles when you were looking through binoculars, so you had to put them somewhere. And so I put them on the tin hat and put the tin hat on the bracket, and we all used to do this. And you'd come out of action sometimes, and you'd find as many as 6 holes in the tin hat, which was probably about 6 inches from your head, because you can imagine a sniper looking down, he would see the tin hat and the goggles and think that was the head, so he'd shoot at that. But that dark smudge on the right, he couldn't see that so easily. So that system undoubtedly was another one of my 9 lives that was saved.
In terms of a comment you made earlier as regards armoured tactics, how would you deploy and fight your troop tactically?
Yes, that's right. Well, the teaching I said earlier on at Sandhurst was always the same, which was that you send out to the left or to the right or both at once an encircling movement, which would then come in at 90 degrees to the line of advance, and then you'd also have another force which would in fact fire at them head on, so that they were being shot at in, if you like, in 3 ways at once, or being encircled. And now that might have been all right on the Donetsk Basin, or whatever they called it, or in the desert where there was all this sort of flying about over vast areas of land. But when you think about Normandy, you couldn't possibly fight like that. If you tried to advance and turn right in some sort of wood and put your flank to the Germans, they would have you quicker than soft meat. I mean, there was no question. You just had no chance whatsoever if you turned sideways on and weren't... well, in any event, we didn't have much of a chance head-on, as you know. I mean, the Sherman was no match for their guns. But the fact of the matter was that sideways on was just ridiculous. It was just not the thing to do. In any event, you can't really fight a tank sideways on. You have to really fight it forward, facing forward. That's the proper way to fight a tank. And so consequently, our tactics for dealing with the Germans in the way of moving forward, there were two main aspects of fighting the tanks. The first one was moving forward, and the second one was dealing with the enemy when you knew him there, knew he was there. Actually, I've got it in the wrong order. The first thing is dealing with the enemy when you knew where he was, and then moving forward. Now, basically, as a troop leader, I would be given instructions by John Semkin that I was to be lead troop tomorrow on the attack, and we were going to go clean through the field that we'd been looking at for the last fortnight, and we were going to be in Paris in the morning. I mean, that was just typical of the sort of cobblers that they used to say to us. And Paris, incidentally, was about 500 miles, 300 miles ahead or something, or whatever it was. But it's ridiculous. You didn't advance like that. You did field by field, ever so limited. We did get a move on later on, but that's when the Germans were totally in disarray. But when the Germans were in their sort of normal condition, there's no way in which you went flying around the countryside. Films with people with scarves around their necks, you know, the Battle of the Bulge, and flying through with flags flying on pennants and all that. It's the biggest load of cobblers, as far as the war's concerned, that ever anybody thought up. War was not fought like that. It wasn't fought like a flotilla of ships all sort of flying through with spray flying. Nothing like that at all. The infantry couldn't keep up with you if you started going on like that, and you needed infantry near you to protect you. The fact of the matter is that you did it carefully and with forethought, malice of forethought, if you like. You didn't just go blinding in. Anybody who went blinding in was dead with us. Don't forget, it was alive or dead anyway with us. There were no half measures. Now, the point is then that what you first had to do was to find out where your enemy was. Now, there are two things about that. The first one is that when you are being shot at, you're not too keen on shooting back because you're being shot at. And we would, as far as we could, make sure that the Germans were under stress. And we, therefore, before we attempted to move as a troop leader, as I've just said, if I was told to be the lead troop and I'd got to go into the next field or the next village or whatever it was, the point would be that before we even moved, we would sit there and fire for about a quarter of an hour, flat out. The men in the tanks, the crews in the tanks, didn't like it one bit, because they knew that tonight they'd got to work like hell and put all the ammunition back in the tank, and they didn't like it. It was enough for them to put the fuel in the damn thing, but having to load it up with a load of ammunition was not a popular thing to do. But personally, I never used to give a monkeys about that one. We stayed alive in our tank. Well, a lot of us did until the end. But the fact is that in essence, if you fire first, there is a sporting chance two things will happen. One is that the Germans or the enemy will keep his head down, and the second thing is that you might well, by a bit of luck, admittedly, damage his prisms or damage something on his tanks. You might even, by a lucky shot, knock his track off. That sort of thing would and could happen. Without specifically aiming at anything, you'll realise. And also, of course, you remember I was talking about the snipers just now. Well, the thing is that they're up in the trees, so, you know, you don't want to go advancing and there's some bloke up there who can pick you off. So we just used to fire everywhere, as hard as we could. Never mind about conserving the ammunition, that's rubbish. Fire first, was what John always used to say. And how right the old boy was. Now, having then fired first, and having done your bit, and the thing didn't seem to be reacting, you would then make your move. Now, my sergeant was 40 years old, and to be honest with you, he'd had enough before I even got there. And I don't suppose he did anything else but resent me as an individual anyway, because I was 19 and I didn't care a monkey's. We were sort of tearaway jacks in our way. And so, consequently, I always led. I always was the lead tank, which was, of course, the most dangerous position to be in. But never, ever did I, well, except perhaps on one or two occasions, did I let anybody else lead. Again, the other thing was that I always felt that I could do it better than anybody else because, you know, well, I don't know, I was me. I knew what to do, and that was the end of that. And so, okay. It was a sort of youth. It's like a youth driving a motorbike. I mean, you and I probably wouldn't drive a motorbike like some of these tearaways do, but they love it and do it, and that's that. So, if you can understand the principles behind it. Now, the situation was that you would then, having quietened the blokes down in front, hopefully, you'd then advance. Now, how would you advance? Well, you wouldn't just go blinding straight out across the field. You would go to one side, up the hedge, or on the other side there, anything. And if there were houses, you'd nip from one house to another, very carefully. You didn't show yourself more than you absolutely had to. And only then, when you did show yourself, you then get into a position where you could fire again. Firing was the whole thing towards it. And that's why it was very essential, when you got into a strange tank, the first thing we did was to TNA the sights. Or I did.
As part of this process, presumably you had to work with infantry a lot. How did you work? How did they fit into all this?
Well, by and large, the infantry hated us. They found that we attracted the shit, as they put it. And they would much rather have not had us at all. Very, very often, we would go to places where there hadn't been a lot of action, and the infantry would be allowing the Germans to walk about in front of them because they weren't firing back, so they didn't bother to fire back. A notable occasion of that was later on in Nijmegen with the Americans, incidentally. But the fact is, it did happen with our chaps as well, with our infantry as well. The other thing was that, of course, the infantry had two tremendous drawbacks against us, or three if you like. Advantages we had was, one, we had some sort of protection in the shape of the armour. Two, we had good radios that worked. And three, we had the firepower that they didn't have. And four, we were up in the air and we could see things. These new modern tanks, which are very low and all the rest of it, I can understand the point, but at the same time, make no bones about it, there's a distinct disadvantage from their point of view. Because they're so low, they wouldn't be able to see forward. Whereas we were in a fairly high tank, we could see above. Of course, it made you more vulnerable. Yes, nobody's arguing about that. But there are pros and cons. There's a pro having a big gun like the 88mm, which could fire at a mile and a half, but we were saved in Normandy, you realise, by virtue of the fact that it was close country. That was many people thought it was a disadvantage, but not the Sherwood Rangers. In many ways, we felt that it was an advantage because our gun was just as bloody good as theirs at the short range. Or no, it wasn't as good, but it was getting on that way. So it was an advantage.
And in the same vein, what about working with artillery? How did that fit into the scheme of things?
Working with artillery, yes. As far as the artillery was concerned, we had an IO, or a liaison officer, rather, I should say, hello, who was in a Sherman. And he would be phoning back and talking to the infantry and vectoring them in. But he'd be in a Sherman, and they were jolly good. The 25-pounders, of course, that were best of all were the ones I've forgotten the name of the regiment just for a second. The 25-pounders, the mobile 25-pounders supporting us in the Sextons were absolutely superb. They used to fire very closely over our heads, and they would bring down the fire very effectively.
You had your own integral artillery with the squadron?
No, it was a regiment attached to ours. The liaison officer on that, by the way, in the Sherman, could also bring down typhoons, which he did at Tilly. Much to our annoyance, because they came down, and I can remember they attacked us, actually, but I suppose we were so close to the German lines and the German tanks that it would be a very easy mistake to make. By and large, I think at that time, I can't really remember having any form of recognition on the back. We never seemed to bother about putting those day glow sheets on the back or anything like that. The Germans, of course, would stick a swastika on, and as a matter of fact, I've still got one upstairs. I looted one out of a tank that we just shot up, and they would put the thing on the back of the engine covers. That was what it was for. But at Tilly, we got shot up by the typhoons, and I think one of our tanks did actually get hit and knocked about. But I can remember looking up in the sky, looking back, and seeing this plane coming down, and I thought, well, he's on fire. And of course, it was covered in smoke, you see, and the next minute, these rockets came down in amongst us, and it was frightening, really. I mean, they didn't half go off with a bang. But we didn't ever ask for typhoons after that.
But it was the job of the gunner to coordinate that.
Yes, as I understood it, he did it. Yeah, okay. That's as I understand it. He was the one who would phone up, and then they got it through. I don't know how they did all that. But.
And what about the sort of the sequence of the day? At what stage did you get your orders for forthcoming operations? At what stage did you re-bomb up, and talk me through the sequence?
Well, first of all, you've got to remember, I mean, we're now talking Normandy, and things changed as the seasons went on, of course. But if you talk about Normandy, the days were horrendously long. In other words, the first light, we had to be in the line at first light, because the Germans would have a habit of coming at us, if they could, at first light. And the second thing was that, as far as we were concerned, we had to be, we never stayed in the line at night time. We always came out and leaguered. sometimes the tank, the infantry didn't like that at all. But very seldom did we stay in the line in the dark. So we had to move up and get in to line before first light. So you're now talking about getting there at 4 o'clock in the morning or 4:30, something like that. And then through the day, especially if it was warm, it was very difficult to stay awake. But I might tell you that there was a hell of a row if anybody went asleep. And, of course, to be honest about it, I mean, you could almost say if the bloke did go to sleep, I mean, the tank would get done in.